Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. For businesses and investors, there's no doubt about it. The smart money is going green, and the growing movement towards ecologically forward-thinking companies is quickly becoming bigger and bigger. What may be surprising to some is that these socially responsible organizations aren't just doing the right thing for the environment, they're also paying off financially, making their investors money and increasing the bottom line. Our guest on today's program is Dr. Matthew J. Kernan, author of a new book, Investing in a Sustainable World, Why Green is the New Color of Money on Wall Street. He's the founder and chief executive of Innovest Strategic Value Advisors Incorporated, the number one ranked sustainability investment research firm in the world, with offices in New York, Tokyo, London, Paris, Sydney, San Francisco, and Toronto. He previously served as a director of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And in 2008, Dr. Kernan spoke for the second time at the prestigious World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dave. Good to be here.
Now, in your book, you contend that the world of international investment is on the cusp of a revolution. Why do you describe the financial sector's increasing attention to topics like climate change, chemical emissions, and healthcare crisis in such dramatic terms?
I borrow a phrase from some of my Japanese colleagues who've described the whole thing as an eco-industrial revolution. I don't think it's hyperbole because any industrial revolution, whether it's the one that occurred a couple of centuries ago or any major change driver, whether it's the internet, the advent of the railroad, the advent of electrification, involves changing the basis of competitive advantage. So the contention I make in the book, and I absolutely believe, is environmental and social performance issues for companies are moving very rapidly from what has been regarded as irrelevant to the bottom line and financially irrelevant to becoming major drivers of competitive advantage and financial performance for these companies. So the whole basis of competitive advantage is starting to shift. And like any other industrial revolution, the eco-industrial revolution is going to create a whole new generation of winners and a whole new generation of losers. And the thesis of the book is that investors would be extremely well advised to figure out which is which.
Right. What are some of the enduring myths about sustainable investment? And why is conventional investment wisdom on the relevance and role of environmental and social issues so wrong?
I've often said that the logic of sustainable investing should be obvious to a 10-year-old child. But the tragedy is you never have a 10-year-old in J.P. Morgan's boardroom when you need one.
Where's a 10-year-old when you need one?
Exactly. So to go to your question, if there's any connection at all between companies' performance on environmental and social issues on the one hand and their financial performance on the other, conventional wisdom tells us, A, there probably isn't any connection, and B, more importantly, if there is one, it's a negative connection, and paying attention to those issues is, on a good day, a waste of an investor's time, and on a bad day, most days, it's going to hurt their returns. This is always trotted out as a mantra, has been traditionally by mainstream investors and their advisors, pension fund consultants, and so on, very influential players in the financial sphere. And it's always implied and sometimes stated that there's this huge body of empirical evidence to back up this claim. When asked to produce a scintilla of that evidence, of course, they can't. I spend some time in the book going through the evidence not only that our own firm, Innovest, has generated, but we did a meta study about a year ago for the UK government of 100 third-party studies of this. And the evidence is overwhelmingly clear. Well over 90% of those studies showed a positive impact, not a negative one.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this mythology continues.
For instance?
Well, given that paying attention to these factors is going to hurt your returns, it's obviously incompatible with fiduciary responsibility. So if you're the chief investment officer of New York State Pension Fund, even if you're an ardent recycler and you bicycle to work every day, the conventional view has been 9 to 5, I'm managing money for widows and orphans. I have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize the risk-adjusted returns for that. My definition of risk, unlike yours, doesn't include these things. So much though I'd like to look at them, I can't.
Right.
In fact, there's a letter from the Department of Labor encouraging me not to look at them. So there's a lot of mythology out there, and the purpose of the book really is to try to dismantle some of it.
There are actually funds out there for social responsible investing and green investment and whatever. How is your investment theory different from these approaches commonly known as SRI or socially responsible investing?
The two are confused constantly, and I think those few mainstream players who are prepared to even look at these issues immediately confuse what we're trying to do at Innovest and in the book with SRI. And the difference is very fundamental. SRI is a values-driven proposition. It's about personal values, for or against contraception, for or against alcohol, for or against companies active in Darfur. It's not by any means illegitimate, but the primary concern is the expression of individual values, which if you're talking about investing your own money is perfectly fine. If you were bitten as a small child by a left-handed chief executive, for example, and developed a lifelong phobia of left-handed CEOs, and you want to construct a portfolio of nothing but companies run by right-handers, it's your money. It's not much of an investment strategy, frankly, but go to it. But if you're a public fund responsible for other people's money, the expression of your personal values is a luxury you can't afford, whereas sustainability investing is all about risk and return, improving financial performance for our clients, and helping them identify better managed, more future-proof companies.
Are you concerned that sustainable investment is going to take a backseat to people's cut and run, hunker down feelings about investment at this time? What do you say to people who approach you with that type of question?
The answer that I give is that's exactly the wrong conclusion to draw, and that this time of unprecedented risk and volatility is precisely the time when investors do need the more comprehensive, multi-factor, 360-degree risk radar that sustainable investing brings. I think it's an intellectually compelling argument, and what makes it actually convincing is it was precisely using that analytical framework that our financials sector team was able to call the subprime fiasco at least 8 months ahead of Wall Street. So, in fact, I have described the current situation as a trillion-dollar advertorial for sustainable investing.
How can the average investor accurately assess an organization's positioning and practices on environmental and social problems? I think you refer to it as four pillars of corporate sustainability.
The four pillars are environment, human capital, stakeholder capital, and strategic governance, which goes beyond the traditional box-ticking corporate governance approaches and talks about how the company itself is run from a sustainability perspective. Those are the four pillars. But as far as an individual is concerned, realistically, the individual is going to be dependent on financial advisors. So it really behooves the financial advisors to improve their literacy on these issues. And unless an individual or an institution has access to a 30-person research team, the practical answer is you're probably going to have to buy the research from somewhere else. And our insistence would be that that research be, again, risk-return oriented, focusing on those factors in the four pillars that actually go to the management quality of the company, its competitiveness, its nimbleness, adaptability, and its ability to future-proof itself.
Okay. Based upon your research, what are some of the competitive advantages achieved by companies that incorporate environmental and social factors into both their business plans and their processes?
There's actually quite a clear answer to that, believe it or not. We follow about 2,000 companies around the world in real time. And whenever I get a chance to meet a CEO of the leading companies, I ask them, frankly, why do you bother? Why do you spend time, energy, and neurons on improving your performance on these non-traditional things? And the number one answer by far, unequivocally, is it gives us competitive advantage in the HR sphere. It allows us to differentiate ourselves from the competition, to recruit, retain, motivate top talent better than our competitors.
So the best and brightest are looking for companies that address those questions.
Absolutely. Clearly, the rise and the promise of sustainable investing is very much tied to demographics and the fact that a whole new generation of corporate and investment leaders are beginning to come into the seats of power. They're coming in much more sensitized to these issues than their predecessors were. That's making a huge difference.
What are some of the costs to asset owners who neglect or just simply refuse to include environmental and social factors in their investment decision-making? And I believe in the book, you actually cite the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as an example of investing with sustainability blinders.
The short answer to your question is the cost is incurring risk they don't even know they're running and, in all likelihood, underperforming financially. I think most people, I certainly would concede that on the grant-giving operating side of the foundation, they're doing wonderful work. My argument is there's $45 billion sitting in the corpus of the foundation. I don't know, and more importantly, the Gateses don't know, whether that investment is undercutting half of what they're accomplishing on the other side of the operation. For example, maybe they're investing in companies whose activities are highly destructive to human health in emerging markets. for them, it's imperative to understand and to make sure that the left hand is at least not undercutting the right hand.
Absolutely.
And there are examples, many of which I make in the book, of foundations, endowments, public funds, and so on, most of whom have some sort of a concrete wall between the operation side of what they do and the investment side. Many of them are unconsciously running risks of which they have no idea. For example, some foundations give out generously grants to support climate change awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go up the elevator three floors in the same foundation building and talk to the chief investment officer and say, gee, you know, our research suggests that in, say, the electric utility sector in the S&P 500, the risk exposure to climate change varies by a factor of 30 in that sector. Would you be at all interested in knowing which is which?
Right.
And the answer is unequivocally no, we wouldn't.
Of course not.
Going back again to the mythology that, nah, these are kind of hippie issues and they're certainly not germane to—
Boy, there's a whole lot of old school thinking out
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. You would not believe. And in fact, the chapter in the book where I trot out a rogue's gallery of institutions that are making that mistake, people will find it hard to believe because it's so illogical. But it's true.
Why do you describe the subprime mortgage crisis as the poster child for sustainability analysis?
As I mentioned earlier, our firm was fortunate enough to be the first that I know of to publicly draw attention for its clients to the subprime. It was less a matter of the brilliance of our financial sector analyst team, although they're terrific, than the fact that we came at the whole question from a different perspective than Wall Street did. We started out asking, if you like, social questions. For example, is this whole subprime thing even commercially sustainable? Is it socially justifiable or is it predatory lending? Can you really expect a guy picking fruit in California getting $11 an hour to be able to support a 100% full mortgage on a $700,000 house?
Oh, yeah.
So we came in starting with wearing a sort of a social concern hat and asking those questions, which, as you know, have not preoccupied Wall Street historically, to put it mildly. And then we started to get concerned. We dug deeper and found a lot of things that the mainstream Wall Street analysts should have been looking at, which are not themselves sustainability considerations, but just plain business analysis.
For instance?
What's going on with U.S. household incomes? Are they rising at the same level that would be necessary to service these mortgages when they ratchet up after a year after you've sucked these people in? The more we saw, the more we became concerned. Specifically, Bear Stearns is a good example because on the same day we reaffirmed our sub-investment grade rating on Bear Stearns, a handful of the leading investment banks on Wall Street all gave it an outperform rating and increased their price targets for it.
Hmm.
So boiling down the thesis of the book to a couple of sentences, we believe that it just gives you more information about a company, more information about the strategic IQ of the company, the management quality, and I kind of liken it to chicken soup. In fact, there's a short section near the end called The Tao of Chicken Soup, saying that it is impossible for this analysis to hurt you. It's unthinkable to me that knowing more about a company is going to hurt your investment capabilities.
Of course.
Like chicken soup, it can't hurt and it might just help.
Absolutely. Could you share a few examples of innovative companies that are successfully turning environmental and social issues into highly profitable business opportunities?
One poster child certainly is Toyota, and it provides a nice contrast between sustainable investing approaches and traditional SRI. We've looked at Toyota, we've benchmarked them carefully against 15 global competitors on 120 factors, all of which have been shown to have some materiality to financial performance. And Toyota is a AAA company. The word Prius is pretty well known to people, and the objective fact is, never mind how many Priuses they sell, because as a percentage of their sales, it's not huge, but the halo effect it gives the rest of the company has been massive. And while Toyota, like everybody else, is having its problems these days, their problems pale by comparison to Detroit's. And I would argue that a major reason for that is they were very, very early to pick up on the significance of energy efficiency, fuel efficiency, and the environment.
Of all of today's pressing and distressing environmental and social problems, which, in your mind, has the most potential of paying off for leading-edge companies and investors? And if you had to bet your money on just three of these ES issues, which would you choose?
The first answer would be taking a serious look at climate change. unfortunately, up to now, those few investors who have systematically looked at climate change and tried to integrate it into their strategies have focused 100% of their attention on what I think is 3% of the opportunity set. Anytime you hear the phrase environmental investing, you're generally talking about clean tech or possibly carbon trading. And those are both very attractive spaces long term, but they only constitute a very small part of the assets of any major, say, public pension fund or foundation. My thesis is that precisely the same global mega forces and mega trends that are creating the clean tech and carbon trading opportunities are also bearing down on the other 97% of the capital spectrum. And so climate change, in my mind, is just as critical to the competitiveness of ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell as it is to a windmill manufacturer or a solar panel person. So my first set of issues would relate to climate change and finding solutions. And they don't have to be capital bricks and mortar type solutions. They can be software. They can be smart metering. There's a myriad of opportunities there. And with Mr. Obama in office, you'll see a very much different policy framework in Washington that should accelerate that.
Right, right.
Number two would be the so-called base of the pyramid, where 4 billion people exist around the world on $2 a day or less. Conventional wisdom, which has been completely exploded by Dr. Yunus and the Grameen Bank, well-deserved Nobel Prize, says that these are merely the huddled poor who are terrible risks to lend money to and certainly not potential consumers. Some of the leading edge companies that we look at, like Unilever, for instance, have understood that with markets in the developed world maturing and in some cases shrinking, this 4 billion people at the base of the pyramid is an opportunity that's just too big to overlook. And we think that successful companies of tomorrow will figure out how to tap into that market, not only to sell them things, but to tap into the talent and the labor pool. It's a supremely difficult management challenge, which is why we particularly like the companies like Unilever that have been able to pull it off to a greater degree than their competitors. You need to reinvent your business model. It's a whole different set of challenges. But our view is, show me a company that can manage those sorts of challenges better than their competitors, I'll show you a better managed company, and that's likely to be a financial outperformer.
Absolutely.
That gets you two, and I'd have to scratch my head for a third.
I think those are two pretty strong ones. As a concluding question here, what would you most like ordinary individual investors, the 95% of investors whose motivation is ensuring a comfortable retirement, to think and do differently after reading your book?
My fondest wish is that they avail themselves of high-quality advice on this. When they go to their investment advisor or their financial planner, there needs to be more of an insistence on literacy in this area so that the advisors can actually steer them into the right products.
Exactly.
One of the reasons why it's been so difficult to establish traction and credibility in this space is because certainly the early generations of SRI products have had, frankly, relatively shabby research underpinning them, and the performance has reflected that.
Mm-hmm.
My plea would be hold your advisor's feet to the fire, and if your advisor either doesn't know or is unwilling to find out and educate themselves on these issues, which are clearly some compelling issues for tomorrow, then find yourself a new advisor. Hold them to account, ask them questions, and don't let them intimidate you.
We've been talking to Dr. Matthew J. Kernan, who is the author of a new book, Investing in a Sustainable World, Why Green is the New Color of Money on Wall Street. Matthew, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Dave.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.